Hello and welcome to another episode of the Brexit Podcast. I'm your host, Jenna Fahan, and today's guest is a bit of a jack of all trades. Dr. Martin Glynn is a theatre director, poet, and children's book author. He is also a lecturer in criminology at Birmingham City University, has over 3 decades of experience working in criminal justice and public health, and is about to release an EP as a hip-hop artist. As to be expected, we covered a whole range of topics from prison politics and how these might be affected by Brexit, to how Martin hopes to use his music to communicate important academic findings and insights to those who would never usually encounter them, but whom they might be affecting the most. If you can't imagine what that would possibly sound like, stay tuned till the end of the show to hear Dr. Glynn's debut single, Silence. To hear more Brexit-related insights from a whole host of interesting people, subscribe to us wherever you're listening to this podcast, or find us at brexitpodcast.com and on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at brexitpodcast.
Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Martin Glynn, or Dr. Martin, or Doc Martin. All of you both. How are you doing today?
Yeah, I'm feeling okay today. I mean, just waiting for the storm to come in. I'm off to university later on to do a lecture, but I'm feeling quite good this morning.
Great. So we're going to start off with sort of one of our standard questions. How have you been feeling since the referendum, and how has it affected you and those around you this far?
Well, I mean, I would say mixed emotion, because if you're a student of history, although I am, and if you're somebody that reads and studies politics, this was coming a long time ago. I remember, in relation to Donald Trump, these were things that we'd been talking about for a long time. In terms of what I feel about it, on one level, I've had moments of reflection and felt, oh my God, what's going to happen? But to me, I have to be a bit more pragmatic, because it's going to happen. So like most politicians, it's about responding to actually what is going to take place. On a personal level, it is disconcerting at times, because I've noticed that in a strange way, that issues around race, ethnicity, xenophobia, they're not necessarily more prevalent, but they're being articulated and expressed more, because I think that the Brexit has given kind of disenchanted individuals a kind of permission to express themselves, because politically that's what they voted for and that's what they were given a remit on. So I've found that there's a kind of change in kind of attitudes in the way that people are connecting to each other.
Mm. So you've done a lot of work on racialization, but of course a lot of our audience isn't necessarily going to be super well-versed on critical race theory and things like that. So could you tell us, in sort of simple words, what racialization is and how you see it playing into issues like Brexit?
Yeah, I mean, it's relevant. I'm 60 this year, and I come from a mixed race background. My mum comes from Wales. My mum came from Wales, and my father came from Jamaica. And all my life, I've been impacted by issues of race. And so race, for people listening, is really about biological and physical differences. And so if you look at people's lives, what separates us at times is those physical differences. But race was socially constructed. It was purposely designed throughout history to divide. When I got involved in criminal justice work, I would meet people who I would say are clearly racist. I would meet black people who were anti-white. I'd meet basically a lot of people who didn't like each other based on the color of their skin. What I started to do is look a lot deeper than just the individual. And I wanted to look at how are the differences between us promoted? How is it that two strangers can sit in a room and just dislike each other based on the way they look? So I started to look at structures and systems and policies and procedures. And what I realized, when you look away from the individual at those structures and how they developed, that's where the term racialization comes from. So racialization is really the context in which we look at our differences racially. The relevance of it, and it's really important, is that I don't like individual negative attitudes being portrayed on any level, but each of us in our lives are shaped by history, family, community, society, television. So what I'm interested in terms of racialization, is looking at those factors that make people dislike someone because of the color of their skin. And by doing that, I can address the structural issues as opposed to just targeting the individual. Because if I tried to argue with every individual who exhibited a dislike to my difference, I don't think I'd survive beyond a week. I'd just be too tired and worn out. But I also have had to accept, and why I looked at issues of racialization, because there are those disaffected people, like we've seen in Brexit, who are white, who are the people that argue that society left behind. But not every white person who is disaffected feels the same way around people who are diverse. So for me, it's about being more responsible and not just targeting the difference, but working with others to address more the structural issues that affect our lives. And that's really what racialization is about.
Doc Martin, it's Tim here. In all your research, is there one particular facet that stands out that has been really negative in terms of dividing different races and you've seen as divisive that you would like to get changed? Why is the...
Well,
I appreciate it's incredibly complex, but I wonder if there was...
No,
one
well, I mean, well, I think it's really important. I mean, the problem is with academic study, sometimes it's complex for complex sake. You know, I come from a 30, 40-year practice background. Historically, the division of the races was started historically. I mean, you know, going as far back as, you know, the 13th, 14th century. So there's always been a promotion of people who are different to no superiority, you know, whether it's the British Empire, the colonization of India, Africa. You know, I mean, I remember when I was growing up as a child and I used to watch Alf Garnett. Now, my stepfather was very much like Alf Garnett, and Alf Garnett was a very bigoted character, was a conservative, and he, very much like Bernard Manning. Bernard Manning was a comedian. He said he didn't just hate black people, or he didn't just target black people. He targeted everybody. So history has got a role to play in shaping some of those perceptions. Television and the media reinforces it. But I'd like to kind of put it slightly different. In the early days of my work in criminal justice, it was very evident that the polarization amongst the races in prison, it was very segregated, and to an extent it still is, but it was very, very segregated. But I remember one time being in a jail with a group of very hostile white prisoners, and they were hostile because they were incarcerated, they were hostile because I was an outsider trying to work with them, but my difference became a target for some of these prisoners to give me a lot of kind of verbal abuse and threats and intimidation. But over a period of 2 weeks, for the first time, many of the white men that I dealt with experienced the kind of the humanity of a black person who was not going to back down from their abuse, but was going to work with it. And by the end of that 2 weeks, we had white prisoners who had to admit and said, Martin, for the first time, that you enabled us to connect with a part of us that you've just unlocked. And I did it through creative writing. What I kind of got them to understand that the way that we produce bigotry and hate and the way that it's fed, it can be unlearned. It can be changed. Because, again, I'm not being all theoretical, but in criminology, we have the labeling theory. When you tell a child they're stupid long enough, they believe it based on negative social labels. So my approach to it and the way that I've challenged it, and I've, you know, encountered it so many times, is rather than go down negative social labeling and say, yes, you're this, I use positive social labeling, which is to say, you don't have to be that, but you can be this. So the way I see it, most of my life, and even in academic terms, in terms of my life in general, raising my children, I've encountered hostility around my difference. But my approach to it is simply this, that I refuse to allow people to define my difference negatively, but I do accept that people will inherit those negative stereotypes. And my job is to work with them and transform it. It's just that the politics of the day exploits those negative feelings for political gain, whereas I'm very much of the opinion that the politics of human transformation, and I'm not being liberal because there are some nasty people out there, but from my perspective, I've been impacted by negative social labelling and it's not nice. So from my point of view, I've had to work very, very hard to forgive, to change some of my thinking. And so I work that into my life as an academic, as a person in the community. So I tend to focus on things that way.
Now, you mentioned there about using the tool of creative writing when you went into jail. Can you explain that a little bit more to us? How does it actually work?
I've always written. I'm nearly 60 now, and I first went on stage when I was about six. I had a reading age of a 16-year-old when I was about 10. So I'd always been involved. My mum and stepfather, you know, I grew up in a house which was like a library, hundreds of books. So I was a performer from a young age. I was head boy at school. And so when I started growing up in the inner city, a lot of my friends got locked up. And I couldn't fight. And so my mum taught me sarcasm and verbal abuse as a method of defense. And also lying. And I don't mean lying in the terms of big lies. But what she said is that you can use, if you want to get out of a fight, you can use lies to kind of get out of a fight if you can't fight. So when I was very, very young, I became very talented as a writer. I'd read all the classics. Imagine a young black person in school who studied Shakespeare and Charles Dickens and Ernest Hemingway. You know, I got bullied because I was clever, black, skinny. And so what I realized is I was a gifted storyteller. When my friends started getting locked up and I became prominent as a poet and as a short story writer, and I'd written things for Radio 4, and on the BBC, friends of mine just said, "Look, Mike, why don't you bring this into jail?" So I came into jail, and I started to get all men and women to tell me their stories. And in sharing and telling their stories, the stories of pain and anger and frustration, but through it, there was a definite talent. So we would organize competitions, reading competitions, writing competitions. But what was more important is, what I discovered is there's a link between creativity and reducing the desire to offend. I mean, John McVicar, famous armed robber, you know, he became a journalist. Jimmy Boyle became a sculptor. So I became heavily involved in what was called the Unit for Arts and Offenders back in the day, that was run by a woman called Anne Pika. And so I then started to bring creative writing programs into prison. I then went on and I was part of a national black prisoners program that ran for about 10 years in northern prisons. And once again, bringing creativity and writing and as a form of therapeutic intervention, as well as identity formation. And what I mean by that is that when the prisoners I would work with used writing, they could start to change the sense of who they were. They went from being, in inverted commas, criminals, and they started to take their name back. They started to write for their children. They wrote letters to their families. So from that happened, what I realized is there was an important responsibility I had to unlock the potential with offenders around the issue of their identity and to try and challenge their offending behavior through narrative reconstruction.
I'm just wondering, firstly, where did you grow up? And also, who influenced you to take this route in the first place? Was it parents or teachers?
Well, no, in a way, I'm
they
sure
come from within.
The audience will laugh when I tell you this, but I grew up in Nottingham. I was born in 1957, just after the race riots in August 1958, and my father was in it. And so I was born at a very difficult period of history. I had a very turbulent childhood. It was very difficult. I grew up in an area called St. Anne's, and I grew up in one of the last British slums. It's very, very famous. So I grew up at the time of cobbled streets, back-to-back housing, no indoor toilets, no bathroom. So I grew up quite impoverished. So the only way that I could escape is my mum at the time, when I was about 7, had a blue plastic radio, and I was never allowed to watch TV. We didn't have a TV. So I listened to the radio, and I used to listen to a lot of old radio programs like Round the Horn, The Navy Lark. I used to listen to all these programs, and I love them. Anyway, when I got to secondary school, I grew up in a house with lots of books. So in English, I just had this propensity to mimic the teacher. Anyway, when I was about 14, 15, I broke my leg. And as part of me breaking my, not part of me breaking my leg, but when I was actually doing my CSEs at schools, my Certificate of Secondary Education, we were taken to the theatre to see a version, one of Shakespeare's plays, Richard III. Now, I'd never been to see Shakespeare. I'd read about him. And I saw Leonard Rossiter. And to me, if you never know anything about Richard III, Leonard Rossiter is the kind of sound of the Richard III voice. And in the middle of the performance, there was a battle scene, and he pulled the sword out of his... he pulled the sword out, and it flew into the audience. And in character, he walked into the audience with a limp, like Richard III, pulled the sword back, and went on stage and carried on in the play. And I sat down there with a broken leg, and I said, I want to do that. And so my mum and dad's encouragement, school, because I was very eccentric. So I had a school teacher called Mr. Dugan that absolutely let me present myself like this Laurence Olivier character in every lesson. But when I saw Leonard Rossiter play Richard III, I'd never ever seen a performance where somebody came out of character, came into the audience. And I just thought, I want to do that. And so between those three things there, I'll be honest with you, I've never, ever looked back. And when I look at my career, even though I've done lots of things, but I have to say school, which was my teachers, my mum and stepdad, who taught me how to perform, read, voice projection, and then Leonard Rossiter showing me that you can take something like Shakespeare, not only make it entertaining, but make it accessible to a 15-year-old. And so I brought a lot of Shakespeare into prisons, purely on the basis that I found a way to talk about kings and queens with this weird language that I inherited as a 15-year-old. And so once again, as a black person from the inner city, I got bullied yet again because I used to promote Shakespeare and Charles Dickens. And I still do. But the beauty about, I suppose, when I talk about racialization, one of the ways that I can challenge people who are racist and bigoted is to show that literature and music and theatre have been created by every type of person. And so the arts is the way that I can challenge bigotry as opposed to me promoting myself. I can say, this is what Shakespeare said, this is what James Baldwin said. You know, this is what Stormzy said as a grime artist. So it's been that way ever since, you know. So that's how it all came about.
Mm. You mentioned to me in an earlier conversation that in your work in the criminal justice system, you noticed that since Brexit, Brexit has had quite a divisive effect in jails. Could you tell us a little bit about that, please?
Yeah, I mean, if you know anything about jail politics, you have wing politics, which is inmate run. You have officer politics and in the relationship with prisoners. You know, it's not like porridge, you know, with Ronnie Bark. It's definitely not like that. Historically, prisons have been places where prisoners group on crime categories, armed robbers will group, different crime categories group together. But what happens is when you predominantly throw men together at a time of social upheaval, what starts to happen is people group less on crime category and start to form alliances based on their own nationalist beliefs. So I remember back in the day when Ronald Reagan got in and he declared the war on drugs. Suddenly in America, when I worked in American jails, there was a preponderance of African-American men based on Ronald Reagan. The same thing happened with George Bush. So over in this country now, you would tend to have jails where people were connected collectively against the jail. So prisoners would form alliances because they didn't like the jail. But if you've noticed recently with the recent riots, the depletion of prison officers, the reduction in terms of rehabilitative services means that prisoners are feeling more stressed. Then what happens is that when prisoners are feeling more stressed, they either turn to drugs, alcohol, violence. But what tends to happen is there are external factors that will fuel that. So I remember working in Stafford Prison at the time when Lee Rigby was murdered, and I was interviewing prisoners, and some of those prisoners had fought in the armed forces. So when you start to see, I mean, the rise in Muslim prisoners, for instance, has been gradual over a significant period of time, say over the last decade, over a period of time. So 10, 50, I mean, when I started, Muslim prisoners, they would face problems because they were a new constituency in jail. They were trying to establish themselves. But because of Islamophobia now, a few months back, Anjem Chowdhury was sentenced. So what would happen is, the moment you get the promotion or propagation of a significant issue like Islamophobia, prisons will become a microcosm of what's going on outside. So you will find that there will be prisoners who may be far right, there may be prisoners who just don't like Muslims, linking on a wing with Muslims who are just there because they've committed crime and may be targeted because they're Muslim. You'll also get in there gangs from the community who may capitalize on the issue, but again, are all sandwiched in the middle of Islamophobia. Then you'll also find that you'll have traveler communities who will have the conflict. You might have Irish prisoners who've committed a crime in the UK who may have affiliations left over from what's happened in the trouble in Ireland. So what you get is this huge, culturally diverse melting pot that, from a cultural point of view, you say, oh, yeah, it's very culturally diverse. But when you put them all together, it only takes the news is brought in. They only have to, for instance, a classic example would be, you get two prisoners in having dinner together, and the debate about Donald Trump comes up. And invariably, one of them's going to take a side against the other. And then what happens is they're in jail. So the hypermasculinity kicks in, and boom, there's going to be a fight. Now, the fight may have come out because they're bored, because they're fed up, because they may want to establish themselves in terms of status. But what you're finding now is, with the Staffordshire by-election. If you look at the Staffordshire by-election, the prisons that serve that region, there will be prisoners who will be talking about the Staffordshire by-election. And they'll be talking about UKIP, they'll be talking about Labour, and those views will spill over into maybe conversation, but some of it may spill over into conflict and fight. So what I'm saying is that prison as an environment will peak and trough. Mm-hmm. You know, what conflict in prison is nothing new. What you have is just another layer that adds to the frustration and conflict within jails itself. And there are moments like the Birmingham riot that we had recently, Bedford. But up and down the country, there will be points of reference where there'll be conflict. For instance, in Wandsworth Jail, they had a murder recently where a young guy was murdered. Now, that wasn't race-related. That was allegedly gang-related. But when you look at the gangs that were fighting, you could argue that there's intercultural conflict too. So if you put all of that together, you know, when I hear a lot of talk about reforming prisons, one of the things that is absent a lot in prisons is not about whether prisoners are going to get a job, whether they're going to reform. But one of the basic things is, how do you get to a place in an environment where there is mutual respect for each other's differences? And what I've noticed is, unfortunately, it's not as strong as it used to be. And a lot of that is because of external forces that are feeding in to the turmoil that faces prisoners and prison officers and prisons in general.
Now, to pivot slightly, you've also coined the term data verbalization. Could you explain what that means, please?
Yeah, basically, I'd written a lot of academic papers, books, but I really got kind of fed up of peer-led reviews in academic terms. They're important, but I wanted my work to be appreciated on a wider scale. So I was invited to a conference in New Orleans, and because it's New Orleans and it's jazz and it's blues, I just decided I didn't want to present an academic paper. I wanted to present my paper to hip-hop. So I deconstructed it, deconstructed the work that I was doing. I went to a local studio. I told them what I wanted to do. I'd made my article into a poem. I went to the studio. They said it was far too long. I said, okay, just give me a beat. But when we recorded it, what we realized, we had something special. And we thought, well, what can we call it? Now, in the corporate sector, you have what's called data visualization, which is where you can visualize academic data to help you understand trends within business. What I wanted to do, and so I just decided, this is data verbalization, which is to take the key elements of an academic paper and make it and perform it. And that's basically what it is. It distills key bits of my work into a creative form, and then we send it out there into the stratosphere. And when we sent our first piece of work out there, it was a huge amount of people followed it. And what we've done is democratize academic research. So we have people from all over the world, all walks of life, who can sit in their car, listen to it on the phone, get it on iTunes, get it on all of these things. So that's basically what data verbalization is. All it is performed research to hip-hop, R&B, grime, and it's starting to create a revolution. So my album is called Article 51, because like Brexit, Article 50, when that gets triggered, we come out of Europe. Article 51 is me triggering academic research creatively so that for people like myself, one day we'll come out of academia in the same way we're coming out of Brexit. So
if somebody wanted to listen to your hip hop presentation from when you went to New Orleans, where would they, can they go on YouTube and find it there?
Yeah. I mean, if you at the moment, because I don't really like doing videos. What I like to do is I like people to listen to what I've got to say. I mean, we're working on some videos, but if you go onto iTunes, if you go onto Spotify, Amazon. You can get the first piece of work that I did called Silenced, which has been out now for about 6 months. And then the album, which is called Article 51, that comes out on Spotify and Amazon and iTunes, probably in the next couple of weeks. But just as a final thought, I'm very keen to connect with people who may have a report, may have data that they want to share with the world, but they just don't actually know how to look at creative ways to do it. So it could be from rock, it could be turning into a rock musical, an operetta. It doesn't really make no difference. I use hip-hop because I communicate to the streets. Other people have different mediums. What is important is if you've got data and you want to turn it into something creative and get your message out there that's robust academically but actually accessible in academic terms, feel free, you can track me down on the internet and get in touch, because I'm very interested in creating a movement of ideas that is driven by solid academic ideas but presented in ways where the average person on the street doesn't have to wade through academic journals.
There's been so much information and so much data going on around Brexit, and I'm assuming this will only get more as we progress along this sort of journey of leaving the EU. It's really easy for people to get fatigued with it. So do you think data verbalization has some part to play in sort of keeping people engaged and keeping people up to date of what's happening with Brexit?
I can tell you this now, for politicians who are ideologically driven, for academics who are academically driven, I can tell you with data verbalization, one of the things that we've demonstrated is we've now got people in the streets who, as a consequence of my work, understand why they were incarcerated, understand why things are the way they are. When I look at the Brexit campaign, one of the things that's very evident to me is that there's an absence of, you know, there's a lot of comedians telling cute jokes, but they're getting paid lots of money to tell cute jokes about Brexit. I don't really want to poke fun at the politicians and stuff like that. What I'm interested in, and one of the key elements that happened in Brexit, is that because of the way in which the referendum was conducted, based on the vitriolic way politicians attacked each other, and based on the misinformation that was given, what I wanted to do is to find a way to sift through the information, things like Article 50, you know, actually what is it? And so that you can, people who are going to Tesco and Asda, going to a coffee shop, people who can't read and write, somebody who's homeless, who's got a mobile phone, can listen to something and without going through all of the red tape, can actually say, oh, you know something, I really get this, I understand that. So the way I see it, what I've learned with music, even podcasting with what you're doing, which is very, very important for people to understand, is that not everybody is intellectually savvy. Not everybody has access to lots and lots of data online. Not everybody knows how to research the reports. Not everybody knows how to study the manifestos and what's happening in the European Union. Some people don't have the time. But I can tell you one thing, when you're sitting in your car and you're feeling low, you switch the radio on, whether you're listening to Beethoven, Radio 1, Storm Days of Grimes, your favourite Bob Marley track. So what I'm doing is taking that music but putting an alternative message where you can nod your head, you can close your eyes, and then in your subconscious plant some of these seeds but enable other people to do it. So rather than it become me developing a profile as an artist, I just become a catalyst to enable everybody to explore their own views on it. And if you look, podcasting, blogging, vlogging, it was people that said online, we're going to explore and express the things that are important to us. What I'm doing is taking it a stage further by putting it to music that excluded people listen to, but without some of the messages. So at the moment in the hip-hop community, there's not a lot of messages about Brexit. You know, within the grime community, because people in the streets have a lot more priorities right now than just looking at Brexit. But what I'm doing is preparing people for the things yet to come. So my album, Article 51, is a classic example that the key messages that are contained in the album will not be centered by any of the politicians or academics in a way that's accessible and also entertaining. So in a way, I would say, yes, it's the beginning of a lyrical revolution, and it's going to be triggered by Article 51. But more importantly, you know, I have to say to people like yourselves who are using this medium to give people like me a platform, all we're doing is we're connecting the dots. So the way I see it, you know, in conclusion, 50-odd years ago when I started with one thing in mind. I never, ever wanted people to go through what I went through as a child of parents of a mixed relationship. And in 2017, I find it's even worse, and it's brought me back to that place. But, in 1958, sorry, 57, when I was born, we didn't have the internet. We didn't have social services. We didn't have places where you could bring the voices and create a platform. In 2017, we have. So the same way I'm an advocate of saying go and vote, I'm also an advocate of saying to the average person out there, create a platform, get your voice out there, present yourselves. Don't break the law, because that's not really what it's about. What it's about, empower people, inspire people, motivate people, get those people who have no voice to give them a voice, get the elderly out, and get them to do something to Gilbert and Sullivan, whatever it is, but we need more voices to be able to not just protest, but to explain, guide, shape, and inform.
Martin, thank you so much. As a way of goodbye and in place of our usual theme song, we're now going to play your debut single, Silence. Thank you again so much for coming on. It was really interesting.
Thank you very much, and I look forward to hopefully talking again.
Sounds, big sounds, small sounds, sounds. Sounds of hate, sounds of whispering, sounds. Sounds of loneliness, sounds of desire, sounds of need, sounds of freedom, sounds of thought, sounds of hope, sounds of hate, sounds of dreaming, sounds of pain, sounds of weeping, sounds of hurting, sounds of wanting, sounds of screaming, sounds of memories, sound of the future, sounds of endless moment. Sounds without meaning, sounds without purpose, sounds without hope, sounds of hows, if, but, maybe, sounds of yesterday, sounds of times gone by, sounds of mass incarceration, sounds of black men being shot by the police, sounds. Sounds of futility, sounds of the death penalty, sounds of the far right, sounds of civil and human rights, sounds of black power, black panthers, black nationalism, black lives matter, black lives don't matter, apartheid. Sounds. Sounds of segregation, sounds of the Niagara movement, Harlem Renaissance, negritude, the black arts movement, sounds of black poetry, black theater, black music, gospel, blues, jazz, hip-hop, reggae, soca, afrobeat, calypso, sounds of Ferguson, sounds of Charleston, sounds. Sounds of the new Jim Crow, sounds of black resistance, sounds of black struggle, sounds of black revolution, sounds of black intellectual ideas, sounds of black consciousness, sounds of black solutions, sounds of black liberation, sounds of black freedom, sounds of black peace. Sounds. Sounds of black pain. Sounds. Ever since the fate of African peoples was debated, signed, sealed, and decided, their descendants have been enslaved, oppressed, scattered, vilified, and derided. Many white historians have made claims using methods that are poorly analytical, whilst many black scholars have tried to make the agenda much blacker and more political. And in spite of all the research that's been funded, carried out, tested, and conducted, the race and crime debate falls on deaf ears and is badly negated and badly corrupted. Whilst the privileged elite ignore their implicit bias, necessary changes are overtly resisted, as the machinery of control and risk by the corporate world is privatized and duly enlisted. Discussing racial disparity and criminal justice in academia is hardly ever shared. This omission can no longer be tolerated, must be challenged, and must be aired. We need a new lens to view the issues that must be made visible and brought to the fore, and focus less on the symptoms of inequalities and focus more on the core. Desistance explains how offenders come off the road and terminate their offending, whilst mass incarceration for black people as a whole is growing and never ever ending. As intersectionality talks about the different social locations connected to systems of power, the criminal justice system's racialized motto screams to control, oppress, and devour. How do we erode institutional power that maintains and sustains racist policies and practice? And how do we address the systemic context that oppresses by turning bias on its axis? How can black offenders cease offending if their dreams are not embraced and supported? And how can they tell their own stories if their voices are always silenced and always thwarted? How do they begin to see a future when colorblind research is academic norm? When statistics obscure the lived reality of race using methods that are tired and worn? How then can black offenders experience meaningful and productive reintegration if ideas that are supposed to assist them increases, not reduces, their subordination? Desistance for black offenders requires pushing forward racial justice goals and needs, provide insights and context, and expose how the criminal justice system consumes and feeds. It should then generate a counter-narrative telling stories of black resistance, that will create a pathway and a transition towards their re-entry and their desistance. Black scholars must contest and remove systems of inequality and racialized subordination. To do so, what Garvey said, some unified collective politicized coordination. This counter-narrative must move beyond mere descriptive accounts of black oppression, where the emerging truths become a tipping point for action, transition, and yes, progression. How can black offenders be effectively worked with and properly be rehabilitated? How can we stop the moral panic when the right wing wants black offenders annihilated? How can intersectional processes in criminal justice systems be better understood? And how can disparities be addressed, improving things for everyone's greater good? How can rehabilitative processes engage black offenders where they are context dependent, if their resistance is impeded by a system that offers them nothing remotely transcendent? How do they re-enter from prison when there are major obstacles to staying crime-free, when the racialization of the social structure turns the lock and then throws away the key? To successfully desist, black offenders need to return back to their home communities, where both sides are brought together to explore mutual benefits and real opportunities. Work needs to be done to help them understand about the victims they have affected, using restorative means, building social capital where they are relocated and reconnected, where efforts are made to create meaningful opportunities that will support and engage, where hopes and dreams that will enable them to have a second chance and turn a new page, where they will be able to propel themselves, creating the pathways that enable them to desist. Otherwise, their bid for freedom will be taken away, as the criminal justice will insist. Whilst black offenders threaten the social order that protects the interests of the elite, opposition must be constant where blame is laid firmly at the system's feet. Desistance must include a new way to improve black self-concept and increase racial pride, whilst effective theoretical ideas must be driven out and exposed with nowhere to hide. Black misincarceration must be reframed within a new political and historical frame, where notions of control, power and privilege are cast out, never to linger or to remain. Whilst intersectionality should include and transcend the binary opposition of race, to show how a true reflection of the black experience of justice can take its rightful place. So what should this paradigm shift consist of, talk about, look like, contain and entail? And how would this position bring about change and transformation and ultimately lift the veil? This revision must envision foregrounding black offenders' desistance aspirations and examine how racism and white privilege are impacting on many black generations. The intersection of crime and racialization needs to be better understood and explained, whilst poor research should be exposed, brought to account, named, and then shamed. We need to defend the infringed civil and human rights of black offenders as a whole, whilst challenging traditional theories by questioning their elitist and privileged role. We must ensure that the counter-narrative of black offenders is given real prominence. It needs to be pragmatic, assertive, and told using culturally competent common sense. We must necessitate and encourage black offenders to transcend all of their silence and recognize racial privilege as a form of psychic lynching and plain old racist violence. We must further challenge the dominant discourse on racialization within criminology and demand racial reform with the criminal justice system without fear or apology. We must oppose dominant meanings in relation to social change and power relation, and fight against house slaves in the master's house wanting acceptance and assimilation. We must provide a new lens to analyze how racism reduces social patterns and how the racialization of the criminal justice system creates its trends and its fashions. We must start to raise the profile of black criminological theorizing about crime as a whole. Start a different conversation, putting Uncle Tom's scholars on probation and on parole. We must embrace and include unified perspectives that enables black offenders to desist and move beyond philosophies and theories that fabricates and focus purely on the risk. Malcolm X's wisdom stated, you're either part of the problem or part of the solution. Where do you stand? What's your position? What is your contribution? We can no longer be bound by other people's notions and definitions of how we see race. We can no longer allow our thoughts, dreams, and our ideas to disappear without trace. We can no longer allow ideas about race, crime, and justice to be shaped by presumption. We can no longer embrace an agenda owned and run by white privileged consumption. We can no longer listen and praise white and black lies, myths, and unrealistic illusions. We can no longer operate with false consciousness distractions and have no solutions. We can no longer tolerate, conceal, hide, and bespeak in everyone else's truth. We can no longer ignore the conspiracy when we have the evidence and the proof. Ever since the fate of African peoples was debated, signed, sealed, and decided, their descendants have been enslaved, oppressed, scattered, vilified, and derided. We must push our truths out, crush the insults, destroy the deceit and the lies. Scholars must be committed to racial justice without fear, without compromise. The system of justice that has failed black offenders and black people is just criminal. Through slavery, colonialism into modern times, the changes have been minimal. The time is now to present a counter-narrative that will inspire, revolutionize, and resist. If the lessons from the past aren't learned, the opportunity for change will be sorely missed. Sounds. Big sounds. Small sounds. Sounds. Sounds of hate, sounds of whispering, sounds. Sounds of loneliness, sounds of desire, sounds of need, sounds of freedom, sounds of thoughts, sounds of hope, sounds of hate, sound of dreaming, sounds of pain, sounds of weeping, sounds. Simply sounds of hurting, sounds of wanting, sounds of screaming, sounds of memories, sounds of Ferguson, sounds of Charleston, sounds of the new Jim Crow, sounds of black pain, sounds of Black Lives Matter, sounds of Black Lives Don't Matter, sounds of black resistance, sound of black struggle, sounds of black revolution, sounds of black intellectual ideas, sounds of black consciousness, sounds of black solutions, sounds of black liberation, sounds of black freedom, sounds of black peace, simply sounds, sounds, simply sounds.